Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy. Hello and welcome back. Simon Mundy here. This conversation is with the former England cricketer turned leading pundit, Ebony Rainford-Brent. I hope you enjoy listening. Ebony Jewell, Cora Lee, Camelia Rosamund Rainford-Brent, how are you?
Hello, you've done well there. You did it in one breath.
In one breath. That's a mouthful.
It is. Tell me about it. It's cool having a cool name, but I tell you what, it's a nightmare on a passport. So I'll call in the bank.
We'll stick with Ebs.
Ebs is perfect. Ebs, that's right, what everyone calls me.
Okay. Now listen, a quick recap, because you've had an amazing life. You've had a fascinating life. And also, I think you and I are cut from a similar cloth. Would you go along with that?
We're geeks at heart. It's basically what we are.
We are nerds. So you are an Ashes and a World Cup winner. You're the first black woman to play for England. You're now a popular voice on the institution that is Test Match Special. A motivational speaker, you help disadvantaged kids. A podcast host. Basically, you're a trailblazer.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just can't sit still. I think it's more like that. But thank you. No, it's been a good journey. Definitely been good fun.
And you've learned loads of lessons along the way.
Loads.
And we're going to unpick loads of them today. And the thing I like about you, I think, is that you are very committed to getting the most out of your life, about being the best that you can be, about things like self-improvement as well, aren't you? You're big into that.
Yeah, I'm an absolute geek. Like I say, I'm a nerd. I don't know. I think it's helped me so much is, I suppose I go into lots of different environments and you have to adapt and evolve. And without, I think, the mindset to like dig into yourself, work out where you're trying to go, understand, without all of that, I don't think I would have done a quarter of the things I've done. Mm. And hopefully, fingers crossed, I mean, I'm in my 30s now, but I'm hoping I've got at least another 30 odd. Then who knows, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe we'll be building rockets or something. But to do whatever we got to do, you got to dig deep. So yeah, I'm obsessed. It annoys some people. I get told sometimes that, you know, after a TMS game, you're having a glass of wine, Ebony, stop all the D&M, stop going so deep. Yeah, yeah. But I love it. And I'm sure you do as well.
Totally.
I'm
exactly the same. People are like, come on, give it a rest. Do you think you're wired that way? Or do you think that is something you developed?
I wouldn't say I was necessarily wired that way, because there was a certain point I started getting into personal development material, which was...
I know the point.
I won't spoil it. I don't think I was wired that way. What I would say I always had was like a curiosity for why people were able to achieve things or have things. So, you know, being a young kid, and I remember mum would say, we can't turn on the lights and we can't this and can't do that. And I understood that money was tight, but then you would turn on the TV, and I remember we used to watch Dynasty. I don't even remember that program. That's proper old school.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you'd go, okay, well, they've got so many lights. That was a basic question I had as like a three-year-old. Hold on, they've got lights on, they've got mansions. Why have they got that? And we can't. And I just, it's, you know, it's not a bad thing. It would sometimes annoy mum, because I'd ask, you know, why can't we? I remember she said something that I said, which was really annoying. Why can't we just go to the cash machine and take out money? And it sounds, you know, a basic question, but I just didn't understand. So because of the curiosity, I think it made me move down that path.
Yeah. Questions and asking why. So that suggests to me that you are wired that way, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I suppose I'm questioning for why. It doesn't mean you're going to do anything, though.
No.
Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to do anything.
And often we need pivotal moments in our life, and you have plenty of them.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the beginning then. 1983.
Oh, dear.
There you were born.
New Year's Eve.
New Year's Eve as well. What's it like having a birthday on New Year's Eve?
It's either amazing or it's horrendous. So either like you get coordinated, you put on a party, house party. I've had plenty of house parties back in the day. Or you're not coordinated and then you realise everyone's doing something and you haven't sorted it out. So you get, I always get double presents. So I never get, birthday and Christmas. But it is fun that you always feel like your birthday is a fresh start, which is quite cool. But house parties, when you're having a house party on your birthday and everyone's up for it, it's amazing.
I suppose as well, people properly celebrating the end of your birthday.
Yeah, you're like, oh, all right.
3, 2, 1.
Yeah, hey. Oh, thanks, everybody. Yeah.
So you were the youngest of four.
Mm.
And you know, let's start with probably the toughest moment in your family's life, which was, you know, your brother was killed when you were five.
Yeah, yeah.
So what do you remember of what happened and obviously how it impacted, you know, you, your mum and everything?
Yeah, it's interesting because I have a lot of memories around that time and then my mind just kind of goes blank for many years. I still remember the moment finding out. It was our next door neighbour, Aunt Elma, had come in to tell us. So she'd knocked on the door, came in. And it was kind of a surreal moment where I just felt as a kid, I just went blank, you know, hearing your brother's in intensive care, he's, you know, on a life support machine and they'd already said that it's likely he was going to pass. So you knew that news straight away. My response was to black out. I remember like just kind of go a bit cold. My brothers kind of went a little bit just, you know, one was jumping all over. One was sort of, the response was, quite odd. And then us all getting to the hospital and, seeing him, it was tough, you know, to see someone you love in that position. I don't know. And that's most probably left me with quite numb feelings about life. It took a long time to be able to deal with that till recently. You know, for my mum, she worked in the hospital, he passed away. So she left work because, you know, she left the job because you just can't go into that hospital with your son dying like a, below that. So it led to a lot of issues, isn't it? You know, you've got a family now going through a massive tragedy. You've got a mum who, you know, money became even tighter. It sent my brothers off the rails as well a little bit at times. You know, they ended up dealing with problems around violence, drugs at times. You know, it just became, I suppose, a snowball for, it's 10 years, 15 years of heartache, really. So, you know, it caused a lot of problems. There's a lot of people dealing with knife crime, you know, at the moment. And I say it's not just the incident, because there's one thing dealing with the tragedy and the grief and trying to get over that, but all the long-term effect, all the questions, all the losses, the hole that you have, it never gets filled, really. So, yeah, it's tough to have as a five-year-old. And I think sport is the only thing that helped me deal with it, because it was my only escape of just trying to deal with everything going on.
Have you spoken to your family in depth about it, or is it one of those things that's been put away?
Yeah, it's a good question. We kind of skirt around. So we talk, you know, we'll say, oh, Jay would have loved this if we were eating a nice meal, but I don't think we ever as a unit went deep. It's just too sore. It sets too many things off. You know, Christmas has become tricky every year. We all just get a bit antsy, and you know why, but we just don't deal into it. I've delved into therapy quite deeply in the more recent years, just because I realised it was a mental block for me.
Did it throw up things that surprised you? Because we can, you know, bury things really deep and almost become unaware of the effect it has on us.
Yeah, I mean, I think my whole ability to emotionally connect properly with loved ones has been affected. I think, you know, our relationships in the family, you know, it's taken tolls at times. You know, my brother actually had a...
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
A son, so he never knew that he had a son on the way. So for him growing up without a father, it's left, and also knowing how his father left, as you know, it's left tough times. So I think for all of us, I wouldn't say it's there's a manual. So I don't think we've necessarily dealt with it perfectly. I don't think there is a perfect way. And for me, definitely, it's something that I continually try and just process, deal with. I think the biggest thing I had to get to is an acceptance. You can't change the past. Like, you just can't do anything about it.
Yeah. Your mum is obviously, I know, an incredible woman, incredibly resilient. How did she cope with it from what you remember? Because I know that she's a Jamaican woman, isn't she? And they have a different outlook, I guess, than the Brits in terms of, you know, get up and just get on with stuff.
Well, this is how deep you want to go, because if you go back, I come from a strong family of strong women, you know, look at my grandma, look
hence
at my mum.
Name.
Yeah, hence the name. And I think I'm going to go deep here just because we can. Generationally, our family have gone through generations of trauma. And you think about everything from the slave trade to arriving to Jamaica. I've done a lot of tracking on this, to have weathered that storm, to have survived, to have gone over to countries, to have gone against racism in the past, you know, all the sort of things they would have had to deal with. You don't get through, I think, with a light mentality and, you know, someone who can't handle setbacks. So, you know, I suppose the tough thing about responses like that is sometimes it's just like, shore up, back straight, let's keep powering through, which is definitely what I've learned, you know, how to just keep going despite all that. And I think that's a thing that our family has because of the amount of, you know, challenges that they've been through generations. I think the challenge, I keep saying the word challenge a lot, but the issue, I suppose, and the thing that I'm having to deal with is without taking that time to slow down and reflect and really dealing with the pains, then that can set you up for problems later. And so that's what I'm trying to hope for the next generations going forward, as we learn about self-awareness and all these sort of, you know, that wasn't taught to parents and, you know, going to school in the 60s, but it definitely is something that's on everybody's agenda now.
I'm a big believer in kind of passing the baton on, you know, and you just try and clean it up a little bit.
Yeah.
And then each, like you say, generationally, things just move forward a little bit. To me, that's like evolution in action.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's also benefits to having that sort of, those sort of experiences that you've had to go through, because I see a lot of people who are thrown by small things, you know, losing a job and it's a massive panic. Whereas for me, I always have this feeling of, well, I know what it's like to live with no money. I know what it's like to sort of, you know, no electricity. I would back myself if I lost everything right this second. Whereas I think a lot of people would panic about a small thing. So as much as it's, you know, it's a tough journey to have come through, people have had it a lot tougher. I still feel equipped to survive.
So you've turned it into a blessing, I think, and take risks as well.
But you're right. I think the most important thing is, like, if I can hold on to that, try and upskill myself through emotional intelligence. And, you know, there's a lot of kids and programs and stuff I work with, try and sell those messages. So you can almost have both. To me, that's the dream, is like keeping that raw survival instinct that we have as humans, but then sophisticating ourselves through consciousness.
Absolutely. Amen to that.
Deep. We're going deep, Simon.
I like it. We're not 10 minutes in. Normally we're just barely scratching the surface at this point. Knife crime, just before we move on, knife crime then, you know, what's your view of knife crime, the causes and what could be done as someone who's been so directly affected by it?
Yeah, there's a lot of cycles, and I would say, you know, you grow up, let's just take, so down the road, well, I grew up near Loughborough Junction, you've got Mike's Field Estate and stuff like that. The challenge, if you're living in a family where the pressures of having very little money, if I'm honest, you know, you might then not be able to get out because there are a lot of cycles that you have to break. All these sort of challenges and barriers, whilst all these pressures of bills and stress and all those sort of things are around, I think it's quite tough for kids at a very young age to know anything different. You know, you grow up, everybody's struggling, and then the way to get out, the easiest option sometimes is to become part of a gang and to try and find a way to fund your lifestyle. And that might be through selling drugs. It might be through all these sort of things that are on your doorstep. It's part of the way of your world, if you know what I mean. That's your survival environment. And so I think it becomes difficult then, you know, the way that you're looking for belonging. So you become part of a gang. You need funding. I actually think all the challenges that exist in that world exist in the gentrified world, but they're just dealt with slightly differently. And so you just, I think it becomes locked and it's quite hard to break out. You know, the one thing I would say, you know, as a female, it was much easier for me than I think it would have been for my brothers. I didn't quite have the same gang pressures or, you know, I didn't have to most probably front up and, you know, look stronger than I am. Because as a woman, I think there's that soft side that allows you sometimes, if you're lucky, to break away from it. But it's being part of that gang world, being part of that, it's a mixture of all the pressures, the stresses, and that is the best for some people. But it feels like, it's not saying it is, but it will feel like the best route for you. And I'm maybe not explaining it very well. I'm not sure I've kind of getting my head around it. But when living in that world, it makes sense.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Well, you talked about belonging. I mean, that's one of what Maslow's most...
My hierarchy of needs, yeah. So,
and if that's your way to belong, and if, like you say, if there is that...
Yeah.
Is that pressure?
And or the other side, the reality as well is, you know, a kid who's grown up in that environment might go and try and get a job, even if they have got their qualifications, but the way they speak or the way they dress may preclude them from getting that job. So then you're into this cycle of you can't actually get out of your world because you're not accepted in the other world.
And then resentment would build.
And then resentment builds and then your only option. So, you know, that's the one thing I think about, you know, social mobility in this country. We are the worst for social mobility. And the truth is, it's very hard to break out of that cycle, even if you get educated, even if you get support, because the other side of the world isn't always as accepting. So then your options become limited. So I could bang on about this forever, but I do think until we genuinely open up access and pass and reality, then only the few will pop through. And you
how
know
do we do that?
How do you do it? So this is one thing I would say. Cricket has been brilliant for me because
sport's kind of unique.
Yeah, sport is one that allows just raw physical talent to get plucked, and because all you want is the fastest or the quickest or the hardest hitter, a talent scout will just go, right, I'll take you. That doesn't change the situation for the 50 that might have been at that same session. It's just that one gets an opportunity. But what if you aren't the most talented? Yeah. What if you are an average Joe? What if you are a C student? Then, you know, you're not going to get plucked from obscurity. And that's why the system needs to be better, to allow more people access to opportunities and also understand what they're dealing with. And I don't think we have... I feel like I'm going on a charge here, but I don't feel we have a society that allows, that has a genuine understanding for the everyday person to make that leap. I think it's okay. I think I made it through because I could hit a ball very hard and I had, you know, that sort of support that made a complete difference to my world. But most people I know didn't have that.
Yeah. Final question on this. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's enough sympathy, empathy for not just the victims, but also the perpetrators of knife crime?
Yeah, that's a good question. No, I don't think people understand the causes, really. Both sides, perpetrator, victim. And so I think what we see at the moment, we just see knife crime. And most people, if I'm honest, if you're living in the gentrified world, all you're really thinking is, I don't want to see that. I don't want that in my area. That's most probably the, you know, I think the average person is, that's their response to knife crime. And when you see it in a paper, oh God, all this knife crime, it's more, don't bring that in my area. Mm. Whereas I think for the people dealing with it, there are real complicated issues that our government needs to get their head around. That's gonna take some time, but I think it also needs a government with understanding, good EQ, and really understanding what it's like for different people. And that's a long-term
EQ
journey.
Emotional intelligence.
Sorry.
Just as an FYI.
Yeah, we'll geek it up with terms.
We'll talk about that again.
I feel like we've hardly scratched the surface and I'm banging on about my views on society.
No, I like it.
Society.
That's exactly what I want. So, right, let's talk then about you specifically. So the first key moment in your life in terms of the direction it took was when the Cricket for Change charity discovered you. And you spoke about the first time you felt hitting the ball. And you remember that first time you connected with a cricket ball and thought, oh, I like that.
Yeah.
And it really reminded me, tennis is my sport. I still remember the first time I connected with the forehand. I was like, right, this is it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's that moment.
So. Yeah, it is. And it's like, I can hear the sound, even as I'm, it's like, because it was the plastic, anyone who played quick cricket knows they're blue bats and these orange balls. And you, it's a kind of a weird, it's not quite a crickety sound, but it's a little bit duller. And I can still hear it. The thing is, I didn't want to play cricket. I was like, I loved football. My brothers loved football. And I was a bit like, why are we playing this game? It looks rubbish. You know, no one I knew played it. And I was convinced to give it a try. And to do that and then connect and then like see the ball go out the cage, it was like a little sort of concrete cage. That was it. I was like, this is it. That was the moment that, yeah, it just had me hooked. I couldn't get enough from that moment.
That's a very important lesson, I think, is being open to trying things. I've spoken to enough people who turned their attention to or tried something that perhaps they wouldn't have anticipated liking, exactly like you just said, and found something that eventually then they ended up doing and completely shaped their life. So lesson number one, be open to new experiences because you never know which is going to set you off.
100%. And I say it to young kids as well. And I you've got to make the most of opportunities, and they are everywhere. And the fact that I was 9, 10 years old, I loved sport and I was already not interested in trying it. And when I say not interested, I was moaning. I was like, I don't want to do this. You know, I was being difficult. And how much that's changed my life. I often sort of say to kids whenever I go into schools, like I talk to them about that moment, say, you never really know. And through the podcast, I've done my podcast, The Art of Success, where I've talked to loads of people from all sorts of backgrounds, politics, business, sport. The one thing they all do, they capitalize on opportunities that you never really accept, or you never really sort of, unless you have that lens or your eye or your mind is kind of looking for it, you can miss things all the time. Yeah. So they are there. It's just about grabbing them and running with them.
When the door is slightly open, you've got to go for it. I totally agree with that. Move forward. So you're obviously a decent cricket player. 19. Jeez. Talk about setbacks. Back injury, horribilis. Mm. Yeah, so just tell me what happened.
Yeah, I'd always had like problems with it. So I had a mixed bowling action. Are you into your sort of...
Enough that I kind of know.
Get it. So you think of a Jimmy Anderson.
So it wasn't
Anderson.
Joined up.
Yeah, it wasn't.
Smooth.
Yeah, it wasn't. And it was sort of biomechanically wrong. So I'd always had sort of pain, been to physios, and they're like, no, you're right, you're young. It's just maybe a little bit of tightness. And I was like, no, I'm sure it's not. Anyway, I was up at Guildford bowling. I was kind of like a mini England trial. They told me to come and bowl at like Charlotte Edwards, who was the captain at the time. And I was like, yeah. Like, this is my moment. And like I bowled two balls and I was like, something feels dodgy. Bowled a couple more and I was like, I'm going to have to excuse myself. And I'm sure I looked to the coach like I was shirking, but I was like, there's something wrong. Got in my little Ford Fiesta, drove back to Tulse Hill where I was living at the time, and like got in the house, bent down to pick up the remote, and like I literally just collapsed. I was living with my boyfriend. He came in, he was like, what's going on? I was like, I can't move. I ended up going to the hospital and stuff, and they were like, right now we can't do anything for you. Long term, long story short, turned out I had like 2 prolapsed discs, pars defect. I got MRI scan. The doctor looked at it. I remember going with my mum on the session when they were looking at it, and they were like, you know, the amount of damage here, like your back looks like a 90-year-old, you might never play sport again. And that was kind of like, that was like a door shut. Sport had been so important for a release from all the sort of stuff in the back, and then being told, you know, you might not play sport. I was in so much pain, I had to leave university because I couldn't sit up. And it was about a year I pretty much did nothing but like just about mope around the house, just about get out of bed.
You could barely walk.
But literally barely walk. So I used to, when I did, like my left leg dragged behind me. It was just a whole world of pain. So I just, yeah, mentally I went into a proper depression because it felt like everything had gone. And it was a pretty dark place. But this is the moment where I discovered personal development, because two things. My brother, Dom, called me up. This is about a year in and I'd gone nowhere.
Watching Homes Under the Hammer.
Watching Homes Under on repeat. I mean, it's helped because I love my property now. But that was kind of it. And I ate a lot of angel cake. So that was, if anyone's like, do you want anything? Can you bring me some angel cake? Like, can you bring me two bags of angel cake? Like, that was it. I loaded up on a decent chunk of weight. So the two things happened was my brother kind of gave me this sort of dressing down, like with a lot of F-bombs in it, like, sort, you're gonna have to sort it out, you have to pull it out, don't, you know, you're listening to the doctor, but so bombing what?
Love comes in many forms.
It does, yeah. He got one of those sort of get over yourself mentally. And then, like, I sort of said, yeah, but this is what the doctor's report said. And he said, well, if you believe that, you know, you're pretty much, you're not one of us. You're not a South Londoner. You're not a, you know, sort it out. And then my mum gave me this box, DVD, CD box of Tony Robbins, who is, anyone who knows him, he's a loud American motivational guru. But it was incredible because he talks about all the mindset, setting goals, setting vision, state management, all these sort of things. And I slowly started implementing them, and it's changed my life completely. That box set of, you know, the goals I then set were to get back to university, and I wanted to get a master's because I thought, right, you know, I don't just want to come back. I want to make sure I finish it and do well. And that's because also a doctor or professor had told me he didn't think I'd make it. So that was like, right, I'm going to come back and sting him. And then with the cricket, I hadn't played for full England yet, but I was like, right, I need to come back. And there was a World Cup, and that was 2009. So I wrote that. So that was about 3 years away. It took about a year to properly walk again, a year to properly run again. And then in that final year, I sort of did enough to get in the side. So, yeah.
And won the World Cup.
Yeah, as you do.
So that's amazing.
Yeah.
Right, three things that leapt out at me there. First of all, the dressing down your brother gave you. I mean, it speaks about the power of belief, doesn't it? Mm. You get told something, and if you believe it, it will tend to become true. I've spoken to so many people who've had, say, diagnoses from doctors, and actually they've proven to be not accurate. So that's, I think, speaks volumes, power of belief. Secondly, this injury, you had a huge depression, ended up probably being the best thing that happened to you. So a blessing in disguise, not being too quick to label something as good or bad, seeing opportunity in difficult places, whether that be getting into your property or finding Tony Robinson. And then also ignoring the naysayers. So this guy was like, you won't make it, and using that as fuel. Again, everyone gets told you won't do stuff, and, you know, not necessarily taking that or not taking that at face value is often absolutely integral to people who do rise above, as you have done. So, okay, you, as I said, you won the World Cup, won the Ashes, got your master's in chemistry. So clearly goal setting was an important one. We'll come back to that. As well, something I heard you say was, because you were the first black female player to play for England, and that when someone told you that, you were actually quite surprised. This struck me a little bit about the power of like living in, and there's something else you said, living in London, and the power of diversity and it being normalised. Because I thought that was really interesting that you were like, really? It hadn't even occurred to you.
I feel like cricket in my home world was like chalk and cheese, because if you went along my street, where my mum still sort of lives down there, every family was from a different place. So, you know, we had another Jamaican family next door, originally Jamaican, so, you know, born in England, but from Jamaica originally. We had Greek, we had Indian, we had, you know, you just go along and everyone was, there was a lot of diversity. So, you know, me going to school and that sort of world, I'd never known a world without white, black, Asian. It was just kind of what I knew. And then I remember the first time, like, going to Sussex in Arundel, and like, you're like the only one, or what, you're one of the only one, and you're looking around, you're like, oh my God, there's like thousands of kids and everybody's white. And that wasn't an issue for me until people started saying things to you and making you realize.
What sort of things did they say?
Yeah, I said, God, I've heard all sorts.
As in racist stuff?
Yeah, I would say ignorant stuff. You know, just they'd never met a black person before. So they're asking you, do you wash? Why is your skin like that? And you're like, are you actually asking me that as a teenager? So, you know, I've had many comments over the years, you know, that are definitely, I would say, ignorant.
Ignorance, absolutely. This is what I mean about about somewhere like London as well, isn't it? When this kind of stuff is so normalised. It is ignorance.
Yeah.
That's first and foremost, isn't it?
And I also think, you know, you've got to get yourself educated in this world. Like, it's, you know, it's fine to say that if you, you know, you live in a hole, but if you live in a world which is diverse, you need to kind of skill yourself up. So I would say that when I was told I was the first, I was kind of like, well, I knew there was no others around. I knew that there was a couple of guys who played for Surrey at the time, Alex Tudor, Michael Carberry, were around in sort of a little bit older than me, but my generation. But I was just kind of like, I cannot believe, like, we're in 2007 and there's not been another. So, and the sad thing actually from our sport. The next next from the female is Sophia Dunkley, who made her debut a year ago. So it's been 11 years gap. So yeah, cricket definitely isn't the most diverse sport. We know that anyway. But for me, that's what the shock was, is just like, oh, I've grown up in such a world where everybody's a melting pot. And then you kind of go into a world which isn't quite.
Is cricket doing enough to address that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The ECB have started on the South Asian project, which is trying to engage the South Asian communities. They're very passionate about cricket. That's had an impact from what I understand. We're working on some projects behind the scene. I'm sure I will inform you about what's going to be. But very soon you'll hear about some projects that I'm personally driving forward that are going to be looking to completely address some of the issues and look more from a strategic perspective. How can we in the next 10 years completely change that landscape? It's about, life is about education, isn't it? There's loads of things I've got to learn and open my mindset to.
Yeah.
But what's interesting, I feel like I had to learn a new culture coming into cricket, you know, the culture of cricket. You wouldn't have survived if you didn't get into the whites, tucking your shirts in, you know, all the sort of formalities that go with the sport. So, you know, everything's about learning new worlds, new cultures, new environments. I think that's vital for your personal success.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let's fast forward to the end of your career. And you made took advantage of yet another injury. And I love this. So, you know, you're reaching the end of your career. As we know, or as a lot of people know, sports people often struggle because your identity is bound up with what you do. You've got all this structure and routine. I've done a whole podcast actually on this one particular topic. And then you got injured. You had some freak thing where you stepped on a ball. Again, turned it though to your advantage.
Yeah, I mean, that one was a tough one to swallow. So basically, just before going out to a tour to India, I'm in the nets, regulation stuff. And anyone who sort of does net practice, you know you're meant to like knock the balls out of the way. You just do. And this one straggler, which I didn't see, my coach didn't see, was just kind of behind me, stepped back, went down, ankle kind of went round a 360 degrees, basically. I heard a pop, but there was no swelling. So the physio was like, "You're all right." I was like, "No, like this is a lot of pain. Like I'm seriously." "No, no, you're fine. You're fine." Basically, had a load of cortisone injections. Just get out to the tour, but I was just struggling. I couldn't sleep. Pain. It was just getting worse and worse. So it turned out like I had a load of sort of ligament damage, all sorts. I had to come back and have an operation. So I was then written out for maybe 8 months. Maybe I was in a boot for a while. Operation. And so that was kind of the first time I started to consider like life outside of sport, because I just dedicated everything for so long now to just that channel. So I started a few things. I did a practitioner, my first NLP course, neuro-linguistic programming.
I've done a bit of that with Mr. Bandler.
Oh yeah.
This is probably my first foray into this stuff.
Interesting.
As well.
Okay, so you are a proper geek.
Oh yeah, proper.
And again, talking about opportunity, there was a lady called Barbara Daniels who just said, you know, why not give that a go? I'd always read a few books. Claire Taylor, who was on tour, would give me, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Yeah. Look at us, proper geeks. I'm sorry to everybody who we've mostly read about a million of the same books.
Yeah, definitely.
And so that kind of, one, I learned so much about myself, self-awareness, emotional intelligence, like learning about other people, being able to coach other people. And then I kind of started setting up thinking about the next stages. So I started doing sort of some work experience, started working a bit with Laws Taverners. And I suppose it just kind of got me set up. And I, not long after that, decided, I came back and played for it. But I think that was the thing that made me think about retiring. Because I realized actually there was enjoyment that I could get in other areas outside of the sport that fulfilled the same needs as well. But I learned so much. And that kind of has sparked a lot of interest and insight for so many things I've gone on and done now. So, you know, I suppose I could have done the same and eaten cake for 8 months. Luckily, I didn't.
Learn that lesson.
Yeah, learn that lesson, yeah.
So with Lord Taverners, that's a charity, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you're developing national program to support disadvantaged kids and stuff like that. So, you know, there's a lesson there around putting something back, which is obviously very important as well in that time. Making things happen and hustling, you know, that's absolutely key, isn't it?
Yeah.
You've got to make stuff happen.
So I definitely say, there's a phrase, I leave it, it's on my phone at the moment, which is like, do you want to create or wait? So I would say all the, you know, right now I'm working in broadcasting or whatever it is. And, you know, you can almost say, how do you get there? And it might sound like I got a chance call from Adam Mountford, who's the producer. The other thing I would say that I have always done is I do love people, but I talk to everybody. I network. Yeah. And I think there's a good book called Key Person of Influence, which is about the impact. Once you get to the point you are so known in your industry and you have a certain amount of credibility, then you're on the lips of everybody's name. So when they're thinking about something, they might call you. And I would say the hustle I did, I went to every single dinner, every single event, every single thing you could possibly do. I would help out where I could. And I did that where there was no money and I was broken, I was in debt.
Of course you have to do that.
But what I would say that laid the foundation for is now I get calls, you know, I feel a little bit awkward saying it, but I get calls pretty much every day or 2 days or with a new opportunity because, oh, someone recommended you. And it's because I met that person, I've built relationships. And I would say that building your network is the most valuable. It's almost like an asset. My friend sent me a paper, one of my best mates, Mushfit, the other day about how your network, you should see it like a living organism that you build up so that it could exist when you die. Like that's a mind-blowing concept to me. But I would actually say now the people I know of all spectrums of the world, in power down to the everyday person, and know them on a personal level and care about them and want to know what they're up to. But then that reciprocates for you is that when people are thinking about opportunities, you kind of on their lips. So I would say that has been the biggest help to my whole life is building that network, and it's worked, like in hindsight, it like it's worked for me.
Yeah. And a good way I think to think about networking actually in very simple terms is just speaking to people and being interested in people.
Yeah.
And instead of just thinking what can I get, also what can I give. Like, I always remember the people that took the time out to have phone calls with me when I was starting out doing broadcasting. And now I know that I won't forget that, and I'll try and pay it forward a bit.
Yeah.
You know, and it's having, it's all about people, right?
It's people. I love people. Like I actually maybe am an extreme, it helps because I'm an extreme extrovert. So if I'm on my own for too long, I get a bit, like I like reflective time. Then once I'm done reflecting, I'm like, right, where's everybody at? Where's the party at? Where are people at? I want to talk. And I think that helps because if you maybe not so extroverted, it might not work, but I definitely think you're right. It's that joint effort. It's, you know, I help you and you help me, and we support each other. And sometimes just listening, or you know, just a little idea. And I think one thing I would say, a bit of a tip I've taken actually, is when you're working with somebody who's maybe higher up, much more established, and you think, what can I bring to them? Sometimes just bring in energy and curiosity. They think, do you know what? I remember being that sort of young, energetic person. So they get enough out of that experience. So, you know, never underestimate what you can bring to an interaction.
What was your motto on your phone that you said?
So I've got wait or create.
I'll show you mine, one that I got off my dad that I like. It's the squeaky wheel that gets fixed.
Explain that.
As in, the wheel that gets the attention is the one that makes the noise.
Yeah.
And I love that. So it's like in a big company, or if you're starting out, no one's going to hear you unless you get
are
out
the,
there
and make noise. I like that.
It's not on my phone.
It's not on your phone. Get it on your phone.
Right, now we've covered loads of lessons already, but let's rattle through some of it, because you've got some great ones. And I thought a nice place to actually start was actually, let's have a very quick chat about some NLP stuff.
Okay? Yeah.
So three that I sort of kind of remember, anchoring, reframing, and visualization. Yeah. So anchoring, because I know you're into this, aren't you? Just explain how this can work.
Yeah, so it can help in so many ways. So anchoring is basically a tool that you use for state management, like getting yourself
in the right frame of mind.
So how it worked in my cricket, I just kind of used to go out, open the batting, and just used to go out and swipe everywhere. You know, just didn't think, didn't get myself in state, and how I would approach each innings varied. When I learned about anchoring, I realized like I had to go through the same routines. I became very sort of meticulous in how I used to calm myself down, take myself away from people, cross the line in the same sort of way. And my results started going through the roof just because I learned how to get myself in state. So at the moment, I anchor myself 24/7. This is anyone who struggles with discipline, listen to my morning routine. So because I hate getting up, like everyone, and I hate early mornings, I have a Sonos which plays, it goes through a range of tunes. So it plays a nice, cute tune just to sort of get me out of bed. Then it goes into a bit of meditation music. But I've got an automatic tea maker. As soon as I hear the beep, that beep, I love a fresh cup of tea. That is enough to wake me up. So I set the alarm. So the songs take me through a certain routine, gets me up. Then if I need to work out, the music will change to the workout playlist. So even if I'm like, I can't be bothered, as soon as you start hearing that gym music, it gets you in the zone. So I, like everyone, we're animals. I think we sometimes forget. We think we're so sophisticated. Yeah. We're animals. So we need training to get ourselves into certain states. So if I've got a certain bit of work to do and I know that I'm going to flag on it, I will set up lots of things that will anchor me to get in that frame of mind for work. So, you know, it's such a powerful thing, because I think all the people I see who are very successful know how to get themselves to do what they need to do.
Yeah.
And anchoring is one of those things that is vital, I think, if you struggle with discipline, to get yourself ready to perform.
And that leads into, I guess, habits. Yeah. And the power of habits. So I remember for me, actually, just shortly after doing my NLP thing years and years ago, right? And they were talking about remembering the initial motivation and using that as fuel going on. And I think that night I went to a party, and basically an old guy who I'd seen, really big guy, and I pointed at something and he was like, oh, you've been working out. And that wasn't meant as a compliment, right? I was running a lot, so I had like little weedy arms. I was like, I thought, okay, maybe I'll try this. So I went to the gym every day for a month. Well, not every day, but like I had a month's program. And in my head, I always had that comment. And after that month, gym was a habit.
Yeah.
And now 10 years on, I don't even have to think about it. It's just about making habits. So your morning routine is full of habits. And like you said, we're just animals and machines to some degree as well, or our brains are at least. Getting habits in place.
Yeah.
You just got to get in habits.
It's about the trigger.
And then you don't have to think about it.
But I think it's, if we really respect that we are animals, and I'm saying that, like, really think about that we are just animals that we're trying to tame, then set your world up to tame yourself. So if you want to work out and you know you're unlikely to, make sure your gym kit is in your eye line. Or like, so the way I've set up my place, like I play the drums, I've got all my work, I make it as easy as possible, so there are no excuses, because it's just all there. So I would say that's one thing I've learned, is like set your, and there's a good book I just read actually, it's called The Power of Habit. It talks about create triggers. Have you read it?
Yeah, I read that one.
Create the triggers that you need, and that's massively helped me getting doing things that I can't do, or what struggle to do, getting me to do them.
Before we started recording, we were talking about walking.
Yeah.
And something that as well struck me from the podcast I recorded about that, and I've completely changed my walking habits off the back of it, was as well understanding that we often underestimate how good something can make us feel. So even like if you go for like a really long walk, it's very natural for us to underestimate how much better it will make us feel. And our brain is a comfort-seeking machine, isn't it?
Massively.
It wants to keep us, you know, doing nothing, watching Homes Under the Hammer, eating those cakes. But actually, to understand that and realise, you don't have to listen to your brain trying to talk you out of doing good stuff.
The one thing that I took away from what you just said, I mean, this is how we are built for walking, like as animals. Like hearing that has made me go, okay, I'm going to up my game, because that's how we are designed. So,
totally.
Yeah.
Get your 10,000 steps in.
Well, yeah, I'll start with two.
emotional intelligence. Mm. Now, you talk about the value of this, and so basically, I think this is managing yourself, understanding yourself, and then as well understanding others and being able to get on and work effectively with others. Is that what it means to you?
Yeah. So, practical example. So, self awareness, for example, I thought it was just a like fluffy word when I first heard it at NLP and stuff like that. When I started interviewing people, guests on the show, on my podcast, I was hearing the similar theme of how they were like discovering who they are, what was right for them, and how easy it actually is to be working against yourself. If you don't know how you operate, how you learn best, how you interact with people, understanding what's triggering you, good and bad emotions, you know, just spiking off in anger, all those sort of things. If you don't understand that and paint a picture on it, you can't get the best out of yourself. And then the more, so I actually go through, I have a bi-weekly session where I reflect with a coach and just kind of, you know, I learn so much on that because you're just going through day-to-day life and things are rushing past you that you haven't stopped and really understood what that means for you. And the more you understand yourself, the more you can get the best out. So you can understand where you need to take your career. You can understand when you need to cut back on, you know, you're exhausted. There's so many people I meet are exhausted and don't realize because they're just in a tunnel. Yeah. And actually, like, that self-awareness is listen to your body. When you start getting sort of skin breakouts or, you know, there's illness, all those sort of things often are signs of, you know, you're not taking that time to see what your need and what's going on for you. So I think self-awareness is vital. And then the more you understand yourself, I find it kind of has that knock-on effect of starting to understand other people, mm-hmm. what their needs are. Also, I would say one of the biggest skills in life is being able to understand people. I've spent so much time understanding personality types, trying to understand what drives people, what motivates people. You can't work with somebody effectively if you don't know what they need, what works for them, and how they are wired. And I, you know, one of the things I might talk about, or I don't know how much time we've been banging on, but like to lead, and I think leading is important in life, but you can't just lead off your own sort of, this is what I'm going to do and everyone else follow. You need a collective effort where everybody's getting their needs met and a kind of a really nice environment. And to do that, you've got to understand yourself and other people and make sure your values and everything are aligned up. So it's something to me that is one of the most vital life skills that, yeah, emotional intelligence yourself, understanding other people is. And actually, if you look at the stats, Daniel Goleman did a book, good book. EQ is much more effective than IQ for success in life anyway.
I actually interviewed Daniel Goleman.
Did you? Oh my God. What was he like?
Amazing. Lovely guy.
I want your job, really.
I get a few people emailing me because I've mentioned it. It was really early on in the series and I didn't actually end up putting the episode out because the sound quality was bad. So we rushed it. But if enough people tweet, maybe I'll tweet me.
Okay, please tweet. If I send 100 tweets a day to you, will you do it again?
Because it was really early on and it felt a little bit rushed. But yeah, what a guy. Awesome guy. Massively into his meditation as well.
Is he? Yeah.
Hugely into it. He spent a lot of time in India. Was into a bit of the psychedelic stuff.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting fella. Knowing thyself, as we were talking about, their self-awareness. I think as well, something I see with people like Gareth Thomas, who I've spoken to, Tony Adams, accepting and embracing sides of oneself that perhaps one would rather push away and basically being vulnerable, then that I think leads to empathy towards others as well. Mm-hmm. You know, like we all have stuff about us that perhaps, you know, we'd rather change. But actually, if you own it all and get to know it all, then that helps you relate to other people as
well. Yeah, and I think when you know your dark side, so one of my best mates, Hirsch, poor bloke who's traveled around with me, the world with me, knows my dark sides inside out. And, you know, if you know your dark side, I can tell him, look, by the way, I think I'm going into that place or vice versa. Like, I think it helps the interaction because you're not judging yourself for it. You're just saying, look, I know, you know, I can go from being the nicest person to a 0 to 100 on an anger scale.
Same.
And it's just like, you're like, who is this person? I thought you were smiling 2 minutes ago and you now turned into a nutter. But because of that, like, you know, if the other person understands that and, you know, you accept it and then you sort of start, okay, look, it's coming. You know, you can set up things that help you not go into that place, and you've got other people who understand it. And actually, I think the best people that you end up being around, you kind of all know everybody's flaws. Mm. They know yours and you kind of work with it.
Totally.
And that's kind of the dream scenario for me, is sometimes not trying to fix yourself, just understanding it and working with it.
Yeah, and accepting it. And you can't deal with stuff if you kind of refuse to even accept that you have it.
Yeah.
And also, I think if you own the dark side, your shadow side, whatever you want to call it, and people then prick you in that point, you're far less likely to get defensive.
Yeah.
Because it's like, yeah, no, you're right.
Yeah.
I know I'm like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I know I can be like that. I accept I'm like that. Okay, I'm working on it. But, you know, it's not like, no, I'm not. How dare you?
Yeah, exactly.
Which, but, and we all know someone like that.
Definitely. But I would say it's genius coaches for me. That's their skill. That genius managers, coaches, whether it's a Clive Woodward, whether it's a Trevor Bayliss in cricket, whatever it is, it's they can work with, and sports people have some serious dark sides. I've seen a lot of.
Yeah, yeah. It drives a lot of sports
people. Yeah, and it's working with that to get the best.
Absolutely. Using it as fuel. Right. I saw an article in which you were interviewed where you talked about the five things that you've learned from your pod specifically. So I thought a good thing to do would be to rattle through them. First is a mindset and a lens of the world. Mm.
So that's kind of a mixture of the opportunity. So when I spoke to Chris Akabusi, I spoke to Cyril Regis, I spoke to Richard Osman, I've spoken to some amazing people. This theme kept coming out that they were faced with similar situations, but they saw the opportunity. And I think it's almost like, imagine you had murky glasses on. I think some people are just cleaning that lens and looking at things in a completely different way. An example would be the guy who discovered Velcro, right? This is a really boring story, but the guy who discovered Velcro, I find this fascinating because he used to go on these mountain walks and these little annoying things used to stick onto the stocks and his dog. The average person looked at these things and just, oh, this is annoying, and plug it off. This guy took those little, balls, you know what I'm talking about, and was like, oh, how does that work? He became a multimillionaire. God knows how much money he's made, where the rest of us are,
whinged about it.
Yeah, and I just think that is, to me, a summary of looking at the same thing and seeing something different. And so I think it's important that the lens that we have shapes it. So when we spoke to Cyril Regis and he would talk about the racism he had, being one of the early black footballers, you could have taken that in so many different ways, but the way he took it was use that situation for fuel and how he was going to change mindsets. And it was really powerful listening to him talk. I think two people could be faced with the same challenge, and if you've got the right lens on, you will make the most of it.
Actually, before you came in, I was just having a quick look on Twitter, which I don't do much of, as you know, but I tweeted about the last episode, and someone had a Winston Churchill quote, and it was something like, an optimist sees the opportunity in every difficult thing. Mm. Have you ever read the book Obstacle is the Way?
No.
Read that.
I'm on it tonight.
The Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Halliday, I think.
Yeah.
It's based on Stoicism, which is exactly
that. Yeah, I love Stoicism.
Which is, in any situation there is a seed of opportunity. Mm. If only to practice, for example, patience or acceptance and that kind of stuff. Second, right, we've talked about self-awareness, which was your five key things. Number three was the ability to get ourselves to perform. Mm.
And that was a lot of that anchoring
stuff. And including motivation and focus.
Yeah, so one thing, I won't just go more into the anchoring as such, but one thing I would say, you could have two people with talent, but one knows how to just get stuff done and the other doesn't know how to get themselves to do it. And I see it, when I'm working with young sports people, it's like, okay, well, you need to go to the gym. One's going to the gym. Actually, there could be an underperforming athlete who's going to the gym every day and then ends up getting the advantage because they have put in the work. And it's not that they don't care. It's just they don't know how to. And that's where sometimes self-awareness comes in and then setting up things. But I just think we can lose out on so much potential. I've done it myself, it's like, I think that's the biggest kind of investment of time is understanding how can I get myself to achieve what I'm trying to achieve, and that takes a bit of work, but without it I think we just miss out on so much. So it's something that we got to spend some time on.
We were again chatting before we started recording about focus specifically, and another book that we both read, Deep Work, and how we live in such distracted times. Everyone's on their phone, flitting from one thing to the next, email box always open, pinging stuff, but actually that ability to just focus and really go deep on one thing. Tell your piano story.
Drums. So I'm just learning.
Oh, sorry, drums,
So I've just started learning the drums over the last year or so, and I started trying to realize I'm playing sloppy. How do you get things up to speed? And one of the tips I was given is to play one beat really, really slowly. It's almost half speed. It doesn't even sound like a beat. but for like a long stretch. So I'd play the same beat for sort of 10 minutes going at 50 BPM, which is, you know, you'd almost think, why are you doing it? But what you're doing is you're kind of subconsciously programming it. And I did one this week on a really kind of complicated Bernie Purdy beat, who's one of the greatest drummers in the world. And I didn't think there was any way I would start getting to speed. Within just doing a straight 15 minute of playing at a slow speed, I was able to triple my speed within like playing it the next time. And I couldn't get my head around it. I was like, wow. But what you're doing is, I suppose, you're going really deep into the processes of your brain. You're slowing everything down. You're getting into that, I guess, that zone or that state that people talk about. And it had a massive impact on my career. When I was averaging 30, 40 regularly, this was sort of later in my career where I was trying to make an England leap. And I was like, this is not going to cut it. And I went to see a friend of mine who, Michael Carberry, who's a cricketer. And I remember when we got in the nets, he said, you know, you look at your practice and you're a little bit haphazard, a bit like how we are. You know, you're playing the front foot drive for 20 minutes. You're playing the cut shot for 20 minutes. You're playing the sweep. And I was just kind of flitting around. Mm-hmm. So he made me play the same shot for an hour. And he would vary the length, but he was like, you have to stick with the same shot. And we didn't work on any like major technique, anything like that. And I went out that next season and averaged sort of, I think it was around 80. I banged out like 300 or 400 in a row, which I'd never done before. I hadn't changed technique. I think I'd just got deeper with the same thing I'd done. So it's something that is hard in modern day to create that time and that space. But I think it's really important. Now, you have a to-do list, but I now schedule time in a calendar. So that's something, where did I learn it? I've learned that recently, but scheduling time in your calendar to do stuff and switch off all distractions around
Each hour, really go through each hour. Spoken about cutting back on social media, news sites, switching your email off, all this stuff that actually can leave you with a feeling of fear of missing out. But you do it for a little bit and you realize you're not missing out. You're just training yourself at the ability to go deep. And in that book that I mentioned that we've both read, and he talks about, by, for example, you're in a queue and you've got to wait for 10 minutes. The impulse then is to pick up your phone. Totally normal. Everyone does it. However, what you're doing is you're training yourself to be easily distracted. Mm. And I think stopping doing that enables you to go through these processes and go deep.
I think it's hard. I think that the truth is the way modern world is set up, it's hard, you know.
It's not impossible.
I agree with you. It's complete. And you have to then set boundaries. So, for example, emails. You'll get an email at sort of 8:30 in the morning. If you haven't replied sometimes by 9, someone's WhatsApping you saying, did you get my email? I'm like, mate, is it urgent? And it's like, no, I need something next week. Okay, well, I've got my like email time. You have to then set boundaries with people to realise, you know, I'm not going to get back to you. But it's hard because we've got WhatsApps. We've got Twitter. Did you see this on? So I think it is being conscious about the process and starting to put things in place and developing, I suppose, the new one now is JOMO, isn't it? The joy of missing out rather than FOMO. Yeah, I'm getting there. I still have FOMO, but I realise the impact it can have on your getting things done.
JOMO. I really like that one. Strategic thinking. This is number 4 on your list. Thinking of steps that you can take to maximise your position. And this isn't something that I'd massively thought about, actually. So, yeah, what does this mean to you and how can someone apply this?
I think, okay, so let's say social mobility. So from a perspective of me moving from what you'd consider working class in a scenario where, you know, free school meals, a lot of that sort of, to break out of that and to get an advantage, to get to a point where you are in a decent position, I think just working hard doesn't cut it, because you could be in a job and everybody's working hard. Everybody's working hard and it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get that life uplift. So I think the strategic thinking is, what do I actually want to achieve? And this could be anything, you know, some of the best business leaders, you know, you listen to them and they're always thinking about the vision. I think you have to kind of almost take that time to reflect, look big picture, and then make the smartest move. So I'm sure you've heard of the 80-20 rule.
Of course.
Which is, you know, the 20% of things that lead to 80% of results. So you go into an office.
It's called the Pareto's law.
So 20% of people in an office usually are producing 80% of the results. Or
20% of what you do in your job will produce 80% of the results.
You look in your wardrobe and you wear 20% of your clothes 80% of the time. So I've minimized and sort of, I do a lot of minimalism stuff. So I think strategic thinking is, I would say, the difference that could give you that leap, which is, am I around the right people? Am I investing my time in the most effective things? Where am I trying to get to? And what move could I make that will set that up quickest? I would say that most of my quiet time is what I spend going through that sort of thinking process. And I would say that's the thing, that one of the mindsets that's helped move me through different environments is, you know, what sort of people do I want to spend my time with? And I've got loads of friends of all sorts, but spending my time with comfortable people who maybe haven't challenged me, maybe not have a network themselves, that's not going to necessarily get you another opportunity. It might not break you out. There's a really good book called Super Connect by Richard Koch, which breaks down how we have all these different sort of network environments in our world, but some of them are not going to make a difference to your shift in life. So I think strategic thinking is vital for yourself as a person, see yourself as a business almost. And then as I move into sort of, you know, I'm on the board at Surrey, a director of women's cricket there, and looking at what we want for the next sort of 10 years for the vision of it, you know, you have to, for some people it comes naturally. I think some people are naturally big picture thinkers. You know, there's that sort of Myers-Briggs and stuff like that. And I am definitely an N, but without taking that time, I think, to really work out what you're trying to achieve, and not just what you're trying to achieve, what's the smartest way to get yourself there? Because I hate hard work, if I'm honest. I don't like that much hard work. So if you can find a smarter way to get there and a quicker way to get there, then I think it's really important.
Yeah. And again, it comes down to like reflecting and not just acting mindlessly, isn't it? Now, number five was becoming a leader in your field, and I guess we've sort of spoken about that. So the last thing I want to sort of chat to you about is self-confidence and the fact that we don't need it to do well. A lot of people think, you know, you need to have the confidence to act. Actually, it's not true. And if I spoke to Dr. Steve Peters, and he talks about, again, it's that part of our brain, the limbic part of our brain that wants to keep us safe and comfortable. It's going to give you doubting thoughts because it doesn't want you to extend yourself. And I think if you understand that, you speak into a lot of successful people who have achieved amazing things, but they're not always uber confident, are they?
I would say most people I meet who don't sort of exude that sort of super confidence that we think. I don't think I ever feel confident. Like I don't walk into this podcast and think, oh, I've got this nailed, you know. You start, oh God, I hope I say the right thing, you know, all of that happens. I think the biggest gift is being able to separate rejection from self-worth. So what I mean by that is, if you go for a job interview and you don't get it, if you now translate that in your mind is, I'm rubbish, I'm crap, I'm whatever, you're just never going to do it again. Whereas if you just realize like rejection is part of life and I've just got to deal with it, and you can get back up and go again and you're still okay, you're still whole, then you will put yourself out there more. So for me, it's example would be, I get loads of, you know, you get your Twitter trolls or whatever it is, and they can really throw you if you're on air and, you know, you're getting people say, get back in the kitchen, you're crap, you're rubbish or whatever. It can make you think, God, I'm not good enough and maybe I shouldn't, and you kind of pull back. Whereas actually now I've learned to separate, look, those people are rejecting me, that's fine, that's their approach. Doesn't mean that, you know, I have to value myself and just back myself that I'm going to be the sort of person who doesn't get put off by that. And I think if you can separate those two things, then you'll just keep plodding on, and then you'd kind of develop confidence as you master something. So yeah. I'm sure the first time you ever did a program, you would have been ridiculously nervous.
But OD'd on coffee. I was having palpitations.
But then you've done it once, you think, okay, I've done it, you know, and you just build and you build. So for me, confidence is just trying to get as many building blocks under your armory. And then secondly, when you are rejected or something doesn't go your way, it's like, okay, this is just part of life. I've got to go again, and I've got to deal with the pain of it, but just keep going.
Have you heard of Martin Seligman, the explanatory style?
No, you need to give me this little book list too.
Yeah, there's a lot of this. I think definitely we've spoken about more books than I have with anyone else. Martin Seligman, and I think I'm getting this right, because one of my first episodes was about resilience. And so Martin Seligman, who I think is known as the father of modern psychology or positive psychology.
Okay.
And he talks about explanatory style, and it's how you explain things to yourself. So in that instance of rejection, do you make it personal? Okay, I've been rejected, therefore, you know, I will reject myself, therefore
I'm
bad.
Enough, yeah.
Not just I'm bad at this, I'm bad full stop.
Yeah.
You know, do you, then the next one is permanent. Do you this means I'll always be rejected. So you're projecting into the future. And then pervasive, it's like, oh, everyone would be rejected. It's no point trying in the current economic climate, for example.
Yeah.
It sounds like you've naturally got it down.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I've read a million books, so I'm sure it's not something I'm sucked up somewhere.
Wisdom's not new.
Well, that's one thing I would say. I did a philosophy course last year. I'm always doing a course. I'm doing one on anthropology of sport at the moment. And I could not believe, like, all these things that we learn in NLP. I was like, they had it down. They had it down 2,000 totally. Years ago.
So I listened to your episode with Chris Akabusi, yeah. And he spoke about being, you know, do you want to be an asset in the world or a liability in the world, right? Another way of putting that is, you know, do you want to be on the side of the angels, right? You've got two wolves on your shoulders. You feed the good one or the bad one. Mm. It's nothing new. It's just repackaging it in different forms. And this is why I like talking about sport and the lessons you can learn. It's no different than studying the Stoics. You know, it's the same. The wisdom it doesn't change. It just is packaged in a lot of different
completely
forms.
Completely different
sport,
way.
Brings it to the surface, I think, beautifully. It
really does.
It
really does. Stoicism is fascinating, by the way. I went to Stoicon, which is Gar Sandler. You can tell I'm a proper nerd, don't you? Like, no other mate went. I said, do you want to come to Stoicon? No, not interested. I'll give you a call next time, right? Yeah, and just so many things that, like, there's these fascinating. So, Alistair Campbell, in one of my podcasts, talked to me about how he used to use negative visualization. So, if he was doing something with Tony Blair, he would think all the catastrophes that could happen. He'd get into this mad state, but would allow him to strategically plan. When I listened to some of the processes that they did in Stoicism, they used to talk about negative visualization to kind of enjoy the moment more so by imagining everything gone wrong. So, and I was connecting, I was like, that's the same concept that Alistair Campbell used as a way of, you know, whether you like him or not, he is a brilliant, you know.
Lovely guy as well.
Yeah, he
proper
is.
Nice
good
guy.
Fun. Really good fun. But hearing that, I was like, well, these guys were talking about that 2,000 years ago, and that's an amazing, but not many people have come across talk about using that as a strategy. So there's so much to learn from the old boys.
Certainly is. It gets passed down. Right, we've covered a hell of a lot, and we could keep talking for a long time, I'm sure. So maybe in future I'll get you back.
We'll do a 5-hour
podcast,
right?
There we go. We'll go 5 hours. In America and lots of places, they do go
Tim Ferriss does like a 2-hour podcast.
Oh, 2 hours. Joe Rogan, 2.5-3 hours, no problem. In my head, I've got this sort of self-imposed, actually it's not entirely self-imposed, but BBC as well. You know, it's like 45 minutes
and then
to an hour toppy. So, and we've just passed the hour mark recording-wise, so yes. Ebony, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for coming on. I think we've covered quite a lot, haven't we?
I think we have. Thank you very much. It was nice and deep.
Yeah, and maybe we'll have to write a book list at the end.
Yeah,
like that.
Definitely.
Anyway. Ebony, Rain for Brent, thank you very much. It's been an absolute joy.
Thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed this conversation. For my newsletter called A New Way of Being, head to simonmundy.com.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.